Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
The International Criminal Court this week launched an investigation into reported killings, rapes, arson, displacement and crimes affecting children in Sudan's Darfur region. Sudan has been rocked by fierce battles between the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF, and the army since April, with some of the worst fighting in Darfur, where the RSF originates. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said that Sudan is on the brink of a full-scale civil war that could destabilise the wider region. I'm joined by Walt Kilroy, lecturer in international relations and DCU, who has focused on Sudan for a number of years now, and is also the associate director of DCU's Conflict Resolution Institute, and by Porrick O'Brien, reporter with Channel 4 News. Porrick, to you first, can you tell us, please, about this discovery of a mass grave that has prompted the ICC investigation? What is known about it?
Well, Philip, just to give you a little bit of context first, and I know Walt will go into this also, but your viewers will be familiar with the war that started in April in Sudan. And as you said in the introduction, in Khartoum, the capital, that is basically a power struggle between the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces. So it's two military strongmen slugging it out. And of course, as always, civilians stuck in the middle. But what's happening in West Darfur is different, and here's why. Because when this conflict started, the Sudan Armed Forces started to redeploy out of West Darfur to focus on the fighting in Khartoum, and that left the rapid support forces. It gave them and their allied Arab militia relatively free reign in West Darfur. And what they're doing there now, as we saw, is the same as what they were doing in 2003, 2004. Listeners will remember the crisis in Darfur back then. It was described as the first genocide of the 21st century. And what we saw on the border was basically a really dark, really bloody echo of that. Because what's happening is the RSF and the Arab militia are targeting people of African heritage, like Masalit tribes in that area. And I have to say, when we arrived on the border, I was sort of, at a personal level, I was prepared for the refugee crisis part of this. I was expecting, you know, huge sprawling refugee camps, as we saw. I was expecting the 2,000 people every single day that are coming across the border. I have to say, I was not expecting the scale of testimony, the number of people that we were talking to day in, day out, with really horrific descriptions of how themselves and their family were touched by the absolute horror and the killing and the slaughter that was taking place in towns just across the border in West Darfur. And let me just give you one example very quickly. On the very first day we arrived in a place called Adre, which is one of these main border crossings from West Darfur into Chad, we met a woman called Hadia. And she had just escaped from El Geneina, which is the capital of West Darfur. So she'd literally just come across the border. First person we met, 9 o'clock in the morning, herself and one of her children on a little donkey and cart. The rest of her children had gone ahead already. They had escaped in 2 or 3 weeks earlier with her aunt. And we followed her to this reunion with the rest of her family. We arrived in a place in Adre where the entire extended family were basically squatting in an abandoned property. There was about 25 people there, a mix of four or five individual families. And at one point, Philip, we just asked them for a show of hands to people who had either lost a father, a son, or a brother, either missing or dead. And half of that group of people raised their hands.
There is, as you're suggesting, an ethnic element to this struggle now. But there is also, and perhaps this is a point at which it would be advisable for me to suggest a bit of listener discretion, as we are in the middle of summer holidays and there might be younger people listening to what I know is going to be very testing or harrowing reporting from you, Pádraig. It would seem that sexual violence is being used in quite a widespread, perhaps even organised way.
Yeah, I have to say that is something, Philip, that we didn't investigate ourselves very thoroughly. Although I just wanted to describe one scenario just to give you a sense of that. In that group of 25 people that I mentioned who raised their hand, there was, in fact, one of this woman's oldest daughters. She had gone ahead of her mom, 3 or 4 weeks ahead, as I said. So her mom hadn't had a chance to talk to this young girl about her experience on the road out. I have to say, I have never put eyes on a more traumatized looking young woman in all my years of reporting, to the point that we couldn't even start to have a conversation with her about this very awful, sensitive issue that you flag up. She hadn't had a chance to talk to her mom. The only thing this young woman could keep saying to us over and over again, the one sentence was, "They are killing us." And her face really, really stays with me. Her name, by the way, was Baraha. And in English, that translates as innocent.
Oh, dear. Walt Kilroy, this all has, while what Pádraig describes is correctly, almost kind of two different sort of conflicts, one in Khartoum, a pretty much straightforward civil war, but then this conflict or aspect of the conflict in Darfur, which really echoes what was going on there 20 years ago.
Yeah, there's a horrible feeling of deja vu. I was on the ground in Darfur 20 years ago and seeing some of these similar stories where the sad part is that there was an ethnic element to the conflict that was happening there. There was enormous, there was ethnic cleansing on an enormous scale with ultimately 2/3 of the population were displaced. And that conflict never went away. It became quieter in terms of day-to-day violence, but it was never ultimately resolved. This was always the big worry. As Pádraig has described so well, this started out as a power struggle. I'm often intrigued by the possible parallels. You know, we were all looking at the end of June, you know, agog, you know, couldn't believe what was happening when we saw the Wagner group rise up against basically the Soviet state, the Russian state, and starting to move on Moscow. Now, they turn back. We don't even know what's happened to Prigozhin now. But if they had continued on marching to Moscow and you saw two parts of the Russian military machine, the official one and the unofficial one, fighting each other. That's how this started in Sudan. It was an elite conflict, a very vicious one, and as Pádraig said, with civilians bearing the brunt. Civilians who were already very vulnerable and were already very food insecure and dependent on aid. But the biggest worry was that this would then kick off other conflicts, maybe you might call them frozen conflicts, within Sudan and also regionally. And sadly, this is exactly what's happening in Darfur. It's an opportunity for some. The existing tensions are inflamed and some of the actors, in particular the RSF, seem to feel empowered to go out and restart the project that happened 20 years ago to clear certain people of certain lands.
Does that explain why this has proven so resistant or stubborn to intervention, to brokering of a ceasefire? There are 17, I think it is, at last count, failed attempts to broker a truce.
Well, if you can count them, well done. I've actually lost count of the number of ceasefires, some of which were broken, like, you know, within minutes of supposedly coming into effect. No, I don't think it's the... I think the ethnic element... is one that's very worrying in terms of the long-term resolution of this becoming a conflict that's going to be much, much more difficult to resolve, or a number of intertwined conflicts. The reason the ceasefires have failed, all of them, is that there simply isn't the will at this stage. Both sides, you have the official Sudanese armed forces, and then you have their proxy forces who are funded and backed by the state, who are subcontracted to the state, who turned on them. This power struggle, each of them thinks at the moment that they can win. And it's very hard to get parties to take mediation or peace talk seriously if they each think that, time is on our side, what one big push and we're through, the other side is about to collapse. It seems that each of them think that they have the upper hand or soon will, and in which case they're not going to take those talks seriously. The only thing is if one of the people, one of the countries has some real leverage that they can use on those actors. But at the moment, sadly, there's very little to be used.
In addition to that, Porrick, I wonder, is there an added element of complication here that neither side has an ally or indeed sponsor state outside of the borders of Sudan who will be exerting a bit of pressure or leverage on them to cease fire?
Well, I think that is some of that is happening behind the scenes, in fairness, but I think that's a very valid point. Like, even though in West Darfur this has metastasized into ethnic conflict, also at its heart there is an issue around a land and resources grab, as is often the case here. You know, the RSF are basically funded by, you know, lucrative mercenary and mining contracts over the years. And also, even though it's an ethnic conflict at the moment, we were hearing testimony of people who were being targeted. The clarion call was that they were being targeted because they were African Masalit, but then it turns out that once that family are killed, these Arab militia move in and take their land and possessions. And I know that work is being done on the international stage around sanctioning these two groups. And for me, I do think that that is potentially where the big lever is at, because as always, a lot of this is actually about money. Mm.
Talk to me a bit more about the Masalit leaders that you have met who would see what they are undergoing as being genocide.
So, yeah, I mean, if you tune into Channel 4 News tomorrow night, Philip, we're doing a big investigation where we're looking at one particular town in Sudan called Mastere. And that is a very vivid example of what's happening. We spoke to people who witnessed 52 people being killed in a school, for example. 28 of them killed in, were executed, basically. And we also spoke to the mayor of that town. He's a sort of tribal leader of Mastere. He was in no doubt whatsoever of the ethnic dimension to this. And he actually directed us to another woman who was shot in the back. She was 9 months pregnant, shot in the back, lost her baby in this classroom in this school. And for me, this is when the penny dropped, because I asked her, did the person who shot you, do you remember anything he said, or do you remember the expression on his face? And she told me that as he opened fire, he used basically the Arabic equivalent to the N-word as he opened fire.
Walt, the RSF are widely seen as being the successors to, or the Janjaweed militias of 20 years ago by another name. Does their continued presence as actors on the stage raise questions about how the ICC, the International Criminal Court, did or didn't deal with this conflict 20 years ago?
Well, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, was brought in that the Security Council referred the ethnic cleansing and the war crimes that were happening in Darfur. They referred them to the International Criminal Court. Now, Sudan isn't a member of the International Criminal Court, and the president, Omar al-Bashir, continued to travel around. He went to China, he went to South Africa, he travelled around Africa. And he should have actually been turned in by those countries that were signatories to the ICC. Most countries have signed up to the International Criminal Court. So they couldn't actually do anything until and unless they got their hands on them. Now, I know we're painting a really depressing picture. So I would like to point to some of the positive side. And that's that there's an extraordinarily inspirational, powerful, courageous civil society within South Sudan. There's a very educated part of society. And they brought about this amazing change. They actually managed to overthrow the regime by peaceful street demonstrations in 2019. It was an extraordinary time. And at that point, Bashir was ousted from power. And the ICC has, of course, wanted to get their hands on him. Ultimately, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, will only be able to act when the people are handed over. But remember, we've often had situations where leaders were in exile, seeming to be living a life of luxury, and ended up, Charles Taylor from Liberia, Milosevic from Serbia. So the story, we don't know yet what's going to happen. I wouldn't make a judgment on it yet.
Porik, final question to you. There's one thing I've been particularly struck by in your reporting, and that is the extent to which the term refugee camp is a misnomer, because the places that you're visiting really look like temporary cities. There are so many people in them.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I've seen that, like, over the years. I've done lots of reporting around refugee crises, and you know, when you say the word refugee camp, you're just imagining tents. But of course, you know, these are human beings on the move, looking for shelter and looking for a home. So what you quickly find is that people are establishing, you know, economic structures. The big, huge refugee camp in Adre, for example, is already you're already seeing the kind of trappings of organized society there. So there's a little sort of, there's one strip of the main drag in the camp, and people are setting up shops. There's even attempts, you know, people are setting up small little informal schools. And of course, then you have really amazing work being done by people like the World Food Programme and Médecins Sans Frontières, which is providing a focal point for food distribution. But of course, parallel to all of that, you have the threat of malaria as rainy season comes, and you have the access to these places. I can't tell you how difficult it is. Even we were there just before rainy season started proper, but access is going to become a huge issue for these NGOs accessing the camps, I think, in the weeks to come.
Well, thank you both for your work in continuing to highlight what is increasingly becoming a somewhat forgotten conflict. Porik O'Brien, reporter with Channel 4 News, and Walt Kilroy from DCU. We're going to be talking to vet Sarah Boland after these.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.